From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from around the Latin America and Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. Let's start in Venezuela, where this past week there was an attempt by the right-wing protesters, quote-unquote, the right-wing mobs or squads, basically, to take over the one public television station in the Venezuelan landscape, which is what they did in April of 2002 at the beginning of the coup, so that the private media, the so-called corporate media, the actual corporate media, they were the only game in town explaining events until alternative communications were worked out, which mobilized the people.
Yeah, and I think that analogy with the 2000 coup is very apposite and correct, because for various reasons, because the and let's look at those reasons. I mean, one reason that the current situation is quite similar to the 2002 coup is that the Venezuelan opposition are a minority. They were a minority back then, and they're a minority now. Mm-hmm. Another similarity is that in their current attempt to overthrow the government, the legitimate government of President Nicolas Maduro, they're resorting, as they did in 2002, both during the coup and in the subsequent economic war that they waged, they're resorting to street violence, intimidation of people, so as to try and create as or project an image of mass support that they don't in fact have. I'm not saying that they don't have significant support, but they don't have mass support in working class barrios, for example, in working class districts. They don't have the support of the impoverished majority in Venezuela. Now, what they've done is what they've had some success in, just as they did back in 2002 during and after the coup, is their measures created an economic situation that it was very difficult for the government to combat, because it created such hardship for the great majority of ordinary people in Venezuela. The big difference now is the oil price. Because back then, although the oil prices back then weren't fantastic, and they were better than they are now,
it was sufficient.
And that gave the government more resources with which to defend themselves against the economic warfare and the political warfare and the diplomatic warfare that was being mobilized against them, just as is happening now.
You know, can I just interrupt for a second? Because I think that people should have, those that have the context should apply it here, and those that don't need it. When we talk about an economic war, economic warfare that's being conducted and has been conducted by one class, that would be the property class in Venezuela, against the rest of society, which would be the rest of society. This is actually the same warfare that goes on a daily basis in the workplace, out in the marketplace, and in the halls of government. There is a class war that is conducted by not the working class, but against the working class, by the property class, by capitalist class, by the bourgeoisie or the petty bourgeoisie or both, whatever terminology you want to use, the language of occupy, the 1% against the 99%. And so even though this goes on a daily basis, every now and then you see extraordinary measures being taken like this, like the kind of war, specific acts of war that were taken against Venezuela's economy.
Yeah, and we've seen it so often, haven't we? I mean, we saw this in Libya, in Ivory Coast back in 2010, 2011, in Syria, the sanctions applied against Syria and so forth.
Zimbabwe.
It's kind of standard operating procedure for the United States and its NATO country allies in Western Europe. to try and take down a legitimately elected government. And they're applying the same script or scenario, if whatever you want to call it, in Venezuela. Now, what happened the last time we spoke, we were talking about the so-called plebiscite that was held by the Venezuelan opposition on last Sunday. And one of the interesting things about that for me is when we spoke, I hadn't had time to read the reaction within Venezuela. The reaction was quite slow to formulate itself. But it's very clear that if you read commentary in Venezuela, and one of the things to note about the plebiscite is that the opposition claimed that they had 7 million people turn out, when in fact the capacity of their voting stations, the maximum capacity, giving them all the benefit of the doubt, was no more than 4 million. And then subsequently to that, there was a survey done by the independent polling company called Hinterlaces that tried to assess what the likely turnout was for both for the plebiscite by the opposition and the Constituent Assembly dry run by the government. And Hinterlaces, which is they've always been very reliable and accurate in the past, and much more so than the opposition-aligned data analysis opinion poll company.
And
Hinterlaces reckoned that the opposition mobilized something over 2 million people for their plebiscite.
Right.
And they reckon that the government mobilized something over 5 million.
Yep.
Now, the government haven't come out with an official figure, but the unofficial estimates from government sources back then, before I was aware of the Hinterlaces poll, was something like 8 million. Hmm. And one of the interesting things is that commentators in Venezuela agree, even government supporters agree, that there was a surprisingly high turnout. The government wasn't expecting such a positive turnout as they got. They were hoping for a good turnout, but a lot more people turned out than they were expecting. And that seems to indicate that the historic class interest and loyalty of the majority of people in Venezuela has been woken up by the opposition tactics.
By events. I mean, look, it's not subtle when they start flying helicopters into the Supreme Court's building, okay? And these are not, bits of evidence of mass opposition either. These are terrorist acts taken by people with significant resources. That was the point I wanted to make.
Yeah, so that goes back to what you were saying about the attack on VTV, the government television channel, because that was the opposition know they haven't got a majority. They know they've lost the information war in terms of being able to mobilize support. They know that, and that's why they attack VTV, because what they need to do is to regain the information initiative and reversing their very clear defeat in terms of the information war, because that's what the vote last Sunday meant. But in addition to that, and I feel guardedly optimistic about how the Constituent Assembly process is going to go in Venezuela. And the reason I am is partly because of the results of the vote on last Sunday, but also there have been two defeats for the Venezuelan opposition in the subsequent week, over the last week. One was they called a national strike for Thursday, and it was a complete flop. All they were able to do was to mobilize support where they've always been able to mobilize support, in the upper class and middle class areas where they have always got support and where they've always been able to stage street protests block roads and carry out all the violent intimidation that they've always been able to do. They've never been able to do that ever out in the barrios where in Venezuela, in Caracas in particular, where most people live. So that their national strike was a complete flop, and that was a big defeat for them. I should imagine that they're very worried at a national level that they have no chance unless they resort to extreme violence, which they're going to have to think very hard about doing, because it's precisely that violence that has lost them support. So then, what was the other defeat? The other defeat was at an international level. It's really important to understand that what's going on in Venezuela has to be seen in different levels. There's the internal domestic political situation, economic situation, information war situation. But there's also what the Venezuelan opposition are now relying on, because they know they don't have support domestically to carry out successfully their agenda and reach their objectives in a domestic sense. So they've been relying on the international dimension and the support, the sanctions from the United States, the attacks from the European Union, Federica Mogherini, the European Union Foreign Affairs spokesperson or representative or whatever she is. She replaced that awful woman that was responsible for the aggression against Libya. But she's very much in the same mold. Right. And she, in representation of the EU, issued a statement attacking the Venezuelan government. And so the Venezuelan opposition believe that with that international support, they'll be able to both make progress in the information war, because all that gets reported heavily inside Venezuela. But they suffered a major defeat. I think, I can't remember if it was a Friday or yesterday. I think it was Friday. A Mercosur summit. Mercosur is the trading bloc of the. It actually includes a lot of countries from the from South America itself. Some full members, some observer members, and also I think they have Mexico and Colombia as observers. But the core group is Brazil, Argentina, Paraguay and Uruguay. Venezuela became a member two or three years ago, but Mercosur, led by the right-wing regimes in Argentina and Brazil, have tried to exclude Venezuela from its structures and processes over the last year or so. And the Venezuelan opposition were hoping that this meeting in Argentina on whenever it was, Thursday, Friday, would lead to a decision by Mercosur to throw Venezuela out of Mercosur. And they failed. Bolivia is a member of Mercosur, although it has yet to be ratified formally. It is, in effect, a full member of Mercosur, just waiting that formality of ratification. And also, to the progressive government in Uruguay, led by Tabaré Vázquez, finally came off the fence. And they've been kind of very reluctant to define themselves vis-a-vis Venezuela over the last few months. But their diplomats finally came off the fence. The government finally came off the fence and said that they do not support punitive measures against Venezuela. They support the idea that it's a sovereign decision of the people of Venezuela to decide how they want to resolve their current crisis. And they want to promote dialogue and consensus without applying sanctions against Venezuela. Now, between them, Evo Morales actually refused to sign the final declaration of the Mercosur agreement. In relation to Venezuela, because he didn't agree with it, in its watered-down version, he didn't agree with it, which is greatly to his credit. And between Evo Morales and Uruguay, they managed to put a brake on what would have been a serious diplomatic setback for Venezuela if the Venezuelan opposition's plan, using Argentina as a spearhead, had if they'd reached their objective, and they didn't. Yeah. So that was both on the both domestically and at a diplomatic international level. The Venezuelan opposition suffered two very serious setbacks last week, and that augurs very well for the success of the Constituent Assembly, which votes for its candidates at the end of this month.
You know, it's interesting. That made me think of the fact, just you have the U.S. essentially weaponizing Argentina against Venezuela with the appointment of Macri as president in December of 2015. And now, suddenly, as the U.S. moves against Venezuela at this time in the streets with its proxies and, you know, internationally at the OAS and all of these other places, you also have a weaponized Argentina attempting to, you know, impair or, you know, either impair the functioning of Venezuela inside Mercosur or kicking it out. And each of these little wins and losses that are conducted by the sides, you know, particularly by or against the United States, you can see the United States has each piece on the chessboard like in an attack, you know, focused attack.
Yeah, and of course, one of the deep hypocrisies in the reporting of all these events and changes in the region is all the right wing countries have. Venezuela isn't the only country in crisis in the region. Mexico's in crisis. Colombia's in crisis, although it looks as though it might be making progress towards resolving its crisis. Argentina's in a crisis of legitimacy for its government. Right. Brazil's government has no legitimacy and is in deep crisis.
Not even in front of each other at this point.
Right. The overall situation nobody reading mainstream media would appreciate the overall situation, because it's all reported in terms of this conservative restoration, that this false meme, if you like,
right,
of a right wing restoration in the region, which is completely false, because the right wing in Latin America have no solid political program. They depend for their results on things over which the progressive forces in the region have no control, like the oil price, for example, just for an example, and the overall economic situation internationally, with a stagnation and slowdown, if not outright recession in some places, dictating what's possible in terms of economic and social policy within the region. And so what have you got in response to that? And you've used the analogy of a chessboard and the United States moving its pieces around. Well, obviously they're not the only player in that game. And the other players in that game, their opponents, the progressive forces across Latin America and the Caribbean, all last week, from I think it was Sunday the 20th until Thursday, Sunday the 16th until Thursday the 20th, something like that. They held a big event in Managua that happened to coincide with the 38th anniversary of the Sandinista Revolution on July 19th, 1979. And that big event is the Foro Sao Paulo. Now, what is the Foro Sao Paulo? The Foro Sao Paulo is, in English, that would be the Sao Paulo Forum. And it's called that because back in 1992, or whenever it was, shortly after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the breakup of the bloc of countries allied with the Soviet Union back then, the Latin American left took a decision to form a political grouping called the Sao Paulo Forum, the Foro Sao Paulo, that included all progressive and radical political movements across the continent, across Latin America and the Caribbean. And the Foro Sao Paulo has been a key mechanism for coordinating strategy all through these years, right? All through the 90s, all through the 2000s, and now in the current situation. The Foro Sao Paulo continues to be the decisive forum in which the continental left across Latin America and the Caribbean decide strategy. And in this forum, and there were a couple of significant events. There was the presence of Oscar Lopez Rivera, the Puerto Rican independence hero, recently released from 36 years of jail in the United States, thanks to one of the few good things that Barack Obama ever did, thanks to a pardon from Barack Obama.
I think thanks to the pressure that was brought on from the international struggle for him that made Obama see this on the list of some of the things he could do to escape his the end of his presidency with some dignity.
Right. So that was very symbolic of the commitment of the Foro Sao Paulo to international law, respect for international sovereignty, anti-colonialism, anti-imperialism, and also unity. And the key theme of the Foro Sao Paulo was unity and solidarity. And that there were many expressions of support for Venezuela, for Venezuela's Constituent Assembly, for the Cuban people and government in response to the renewed attack against the island and its revolution from President Donald Trump. And the fundamental thing that the Foro Sao Paulo did was to make very clear that in continental terms, the left-wing and progressive and radical forces across Latin America by no means view the current situation as entirely negative. In fact, they see it as one of opportunity, a new opportunity to renew the impetus and momentum of progressive change in Latin America.
So they're positing this against this claim of a conservative revival or whatever nonsense.
It was a very significant event, and typically it was completely unreported in the mainstream media. During the course of the forum. A celebration of the 38th anniversary of the revolution back in 1979 on July 19th, when the Frente Sandinista de Liberación Nacional overthrew the Somoza dictatorship, which up until then had been supported by the United States. And even back then, the United States right-wing allies, President Carter, some people say that it was as a result of his emphasis on human rights that the United States failed to support the dictator Anastasio Somoza.
Yeah, right.
But I mean, it was more likely to have been a recognition of the fact that even governments, not necessarily progressive governments at all back then, 1979, even regional governments back then were, and governments in Costa Rica, Panama, for example, right, were refusing to support Somoza, and they supported the Sandinista back then. And so, and again, it was a context in which the United States had to respond to pressure from its allies in the region not to support the dictatorship. And right, that was what enabled the Sandinista revolution to happen.
You know, we started talking about the attempted seizure of the TV station in Venezuela, and that's a strategic asset that was employed in a particular way during the last coup 15 years ago. When this group, for example, is looking, the left assembled is looking across the continent, across the hemisphere, are they looking at the media landscape and recognizing that one of the urgent tasks before them is to make sure that there's a means of mass communication available to our side at all times?
Well, they're very conscious of the psychological warfare or offensive, if you like, to which they're subject. And one of the interesting things that during the activity on the 19th in Managua, Nicaragua's capital, was that Ecuador's foreign minister spoke, a very articulate woman called Maria Fernandez Pinoza. And she's taken over from Ricardo Patino, who also participated in the event. But the interesting thing about that is that in Ecuador, one of the controversies in Ecuador currently is whether or not Lenin Moreno, the new president there, is going to modify the media law that came into effect under his predecessor, President Rafael Correa. Right. Although I didn't read anything explicitly about that in the proceedings of the forum, and it was certainly an issue that was discussed about how precisely your point, how do left-wing forces respond to what in effect is a regional media monopoly by media groups like, for example, Clarín in Argentina, like Globo TV in Brazil, and like El Mercurio in Chile, and El Universo in Venezuela, and what's the one in Mexico? Is it Televisa? And they all these huge corporate monopolies in effect, and that was what. That also lends significance to what you said right at the beginning of the program, the significance of this attack on the government television station VTV, because the right wing depend on their media monopoly in order to fool people and present this kind of illusion of right wing strength that is in fact not. It's not based on any reality any more than their political and economic and social programs are.
This is why it's not the most desirable situation, perhaps, but you only really need to have one TV station in a market of 8 or 9 so that when you need to communicate without mediation to the masses of people, you have a microphone from which to do that. They have the other 8. They can multivariate to messaging, to sub-demographic groupings, and use the right music for this and all that stuff. But as long as the people speaking material reality have their own microphone, that's all that's really required. But we don't even have that in most of the hemisphere. And where we do, again, that's one of the first things they seize when they move against us.
Yeah, and I'm turning to, if it's okay with you, Don, I'd like to turn on that point to look at Nicaragua. In Nicaragua, and one of the Nicaragua is very clear about its solidarity with Venezuela, with Cuba. It was very significant that Evo Morales was one of the main speakers at the event in Managua on the 19th. And also President Salvador Sanchez Serena, the Salvadoran president, he made a brief but very important intervention or speech confirming the main points of the Foro Sao Paulo, unity, solidarity, the importance of supporting Venezuela and Cuba.
And we'll maybe pick it up here with further discussion about that event in Nicaragua next week when we speak again, Tony. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks. I'll look forward to that, Don.
Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.